Turning our attention to forensic medicine next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and really pleased to welcome back Deborah Blum. She is the Helen Firstbrook Franklin Professor of Journalism at the UW-Madison, and she's the author of The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Science in Jazz Age New York. And her book has received rave reviews. It's doing extremely well. And I'm really pleased to have her back to be with us. She's been here to talk about previous books that she's written as well. But today we're zeroing in on her book, The Poisoner's Handbook, and talk forensic medicine with her. I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've had a chance to read the book. It's been out not a little while, but not...
Yeah, a good 6-7 months.
6-7 months it's been out. And she's got a very active schedule here of book signings around the country, and really great to have her with us today. You can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And it is really nice to have you back.
It's wonderful to be back. Thank you.
Now, you grew up with an entomologist for a father?
Yes.
and a freelance writer for a mom.
I did. I always think of myself as the slightly bizarre hybrid of my parents. But my mother loved to write. And when I was a little girl, she always made us write short stories for the family newspaper. And my father brought half of his bugs home at one point. And I think I may have put this in the book. He was studying the poisonous venom of spiders, and he had a black widow that he kept in a plastic box in the middle of our dining room table. And then when I went to the University of Georgia as a housewarming present, he gave me a tarantula, and I had that until I graduated. So I really grew up in this weird sort of science writing world. I think it, you know, led me to where I am.
Yeah. And they were fascinated with the letter D, I take it, because...
Oh, it's so
sad. You have Darcy, Dawn, and Dana as sisters?
I do. 4 Ds. It's worse. It's worse than that, because I'm Deborah Lee, then Darcelle Lynn, Dawn Lizette, and Dana Leslie.
Oh.
It's like so embarrassing. And so lots for our childhood, you know, people just called us the DL. So.
Well, you wanted to be a scientist, mm-hmm. didn't you, when you first started?
I was going to be a chemist. And I still love chemistry. In fact, the blog I do is on chemistry and culture. I really love it. But what happened was, I was starting out as a chemistry major, and I, you know, did fine in the class. At least I tell myself I did well in the classroom. But in the lab, I am a complete klutz. I just took that characteristic right into the chemistry lab with me. At one point, I smoked out the entire class with poisonous fumes. And the deciding thing for me was, at one point, I was sitting there, I was working on an experiment over a Bunsen burner, all focused on what I was doing. This wonderful lab instructor, he comes up and he goes, Deborah, do you smell smoke? And I looked down and my hair's on fire.
You had pigtails.
I had long braids and they were sizzling away in the Bunsen burner. And I walked out of there and I said to myself, that's it, right? I've almost killed my entire class and I've set myself on fire and I'm taking a lesson from this. And I decided not to be a chemist, but eventually to just write about science. So.
So you got a degree from Georgia.
And then from here, I got my grad degree here in environmental journalism.
Yeah. And won a Pulitzer?
I won a Pulitzer for writing about primate research, not chemistry. But yeah, so I've been a professional science writer since I graduated from here.
How did that Pulitzer, did that change your life a lot?
It does. You know, it's one of those awards that changes your life if you let it. And I had been around people who'd won the Pulitzer. You know, they didn't want to be too full of themselves. So they went back to work. After a while, you were just someone, this sounds so ridiculous in a way, but you know, you were still at the paper, you'd won a Pulitzer, but you were still working at the paper. So what happened to me was After the series came out, I had a bunch of agents, literary agents, contact me and say, let's make it into a book. And I thought to myself, this is clearly my moment, right? Mm-hmm. I'm either going to do this or I'm going to go back and be a newspaper reporter and nothing but. And so I signed and I turned that series into my first book, Monkey Wars. In a way, it's Be Careful What You Wish For.
Yeah.
Because... you know, I've always felt that in that moment before I won the Pulitzer, I had a better personal professional balance. Ever since then, books take you. Books are such adventures.
Yeah.
Right? You spend so much time obsessively exploring an idea.
Yeah.
It changes the way you think about the world in interesting ways.
Yeah.
And you tunnel so deep into the story, you disappear. Then when you come out, you have to deal with the fact that you've written a book and regain all your social skills that you've lost while working on the book, and you're down in the tunnel, and go out and talk about the book. And every book I've done has changed the way I saw the world in interesting ways. So I've been almost entirely grateful that I went through that door, except for the times, you know, when I'm too deep in the tunnel. Or I feel like it's changed the way I think in a way that I really...
Not happy with, maybe?
Yeah, that I'm not comfortable with, or that I just have lost my grip. and I do feel like that sometimes, too.
Oh, but now you've got a great... You're at a great university and the journalism School of Journalism, Mass Communications, a great, outstanding in... A place to be.
It's a wonderful school. You know, I'm so pleased that in the time I've been there, as journalism evolves, the school has evolved too, which I think is really smart. I don't teach my past, right? Mm-hmm. I grew up straight newspapers. I don't teach that because that would be a service neither to my students or really myself.
Yeah.
And they're great to me. I mean, they really allow me to go into the tunnel when I need to and, you know, dig into a subject that interests me.
So. Well, I could see why you would be interested in something like the Poisoner's Handbook. It makes some sense to me. But how did you come to this particular story in this, you know, New York, the age of jazz and everything?
Well, it's not going to be the answer you're expecting, I suspect. What happened was my previous book was about ghosts, called Ghost Hunters, as you remember. And I'd finished that book, and after I finished it, my agent said to me, you know, you're really getting... And agents manage your writer's career in a lot of ways. But she said, you know, I think you're finally learning to really tell a good narrative story. This is typical of my agent. And I think you should go ahead and write that book you've always wanted to write about poisons. And don't even write a real proposal. Just write a couple of delicious pages. So I thought, and I had just announced to the world that I was not going to write another book because I just finished two back to back. And I thought, could I do that? Could I write two delicious pages, sell a book like that? And so I did. Well, they were very delicious pages, but I wrote a two-page proposal. And my editor at Penguin Press bought it. And then I sat down and I said to myself, well, what is that book about? I've sold the book. I've spent the advance the way I always do. And I actually have to write a book about poison. And all I had really written was poison is very cool. Let me write about it. And so...
So that was your proposal.
Pretty much. And it was a little better than that. So I'm like, well, what's the actual story that I want to tell about poison? Because poison... We live in a chemical world, and almost since there started to be human society, it's been defined and changed and altered and built upon our use of chemicals and poisons. You can go back to Egyptian times and find them talking about death by peach. They use cyanide to execute people, right?
Yeah.
That's a plant poison. You can go into the 18th century, the rise of the the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and find that you first are starting to have mass manufacture of chemicals. By the 19th century, there's so many poisonous chemicals readily available. They call the 19th century the golden age of the poisoner. That literally people were starting to say, how do we put an end to this? How do we catch these people? Too many people are dying. They had no idea how to detect a poison. So in the 19th century, with poisons that are really common, like arsenic was so commonly used that people called it the inheritance powder, literally.
Yeah.
You know, hurry up, Mom, I want that money, and there's the arsenic.
And they could get away with it.
And they could get away with it because there were no tests. No one knew how to get these kind of poisons out of a corpse. No one knew how to measure them precisely. So a lot of times, some of the standard tests for poisons were, you know, you'd feed the dead person's dinner to a dog and see if it died, but that still didn't tell you what the poison was.
Yeah.
So by about the 1850s, you start to see people developing tests for the arsenic, but then they still can't do plant poisons. And there's a great speech by a French prosecutor saying, well, let's just tell everyone to kill people with plant poisons because there's never any evidence. Just go out and do it. I mean, people were so frustrated. So you're coming along into the 20th century, which was what I finally realized I wanted to get to in my book. I was thinking about a number of things as I'm casting this wide net, which is why I know all these stories about the history of poison.
Yeah.
What really interests me, and I started thinking about the fact that we live in a CSI age, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love some of these crime things like Bones, where they go in the lab and they solve it. But that didn't used to be true. And so I started thinking, well, when did that really change? When did we develop the forensic science that kind of affects the way we live today? You can catch killers. We don't poison each other, you know, as comprehensively as we used to. Thank goodness. And I also started doing one other thing in this desperate search for a story. I thought, well, why aren't there any good books about what happened in the United States? Because as I was looking, everything I found was from Europe. Right, which was where, and in Europe, they first really started, you know, chasing poisoners and developing forensic medicine before we did. We didn't even train people in forensics in this country until the 1930s.
It's amazing.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? So eventually, I discovered that these two forgotten scientists in New York City had driven the field of forensics in this country, and I focused it on two of them. The first professional medical examiner in New York, Charles Norris. And he hired the first toxicologist ever attached to a city, and that was Alexander Gettler. Alexander Gettler is considered the father of American forensic toxicology. And once I found them, I thought, I'm going to find that story. That is such a cool story. And it turned out to be a cool story.
It certainly did. Deborah Blum, our guest today. If you want to join in as we talk with her about her book, we haven't even gotten to her book. We're just getting to her book now, The Poisoner's Handbook, about forensic medicine, about her book. I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Deborah Blum, who is the author of The Poisoner's Handbook. And it's kind of about forensic medicine and really about the beginnings of forensic medicine in the United States. And it started in New York with a couple of guys, Charles Norris, who was the city of New York hired. And then he, in turn, hired Alexander Gettler, a chemist. And together, they really, I believe, Deborah got it going here in the U.S.
Yes, they did. They Norris, in fact, started the first forensic medicine training program in this country at NYU. And Gettler sort of wrote the book on forensic toxicology. He was the first person in the world to find out how you can tell if someone is intoxicated at time of death. He did such fundamental work on cyanide that he's still quoted by the EPA. He did the fundamental work on carbon monoxide, among other things, proving that you cannot, you don't absorb the gas after death. And that was really important because during the 1920s, they had a series of staged murders where someone would suffocate someone with a pillow, and then, because they used gas lighting, turn on the gas, trying to pretend they had been killed by carbon monoxide. And he could prove that there was no carbon monoxide in their bloodstream.
Oh.
And he could also prove that you didn't absorb carbon monoxide after death. So they were able to solve those murders from that knowledge. So you have the two of them, the one building it up at the institution and the one supplying answers that really didn't exist before that.
And in your book, you talk about many of these cases and how they were solved.
I do. And just to give you a slightly gruesome carbon monoxide example.
Okay.
This is actually one of my favorite stories because it really marks a turning point in forensic science. And this is in 1926. And the Brooklyn police pick up a guy on the docks along the East River one night. And he's carrying a bundle. And when they ask him to drop the bundle, instead he kicks it in the river. So they grab him. They take him back to the cop station. And when they look at him, they realize that his socks are completely soaked with blood. They're red. And his shoes are sodden. They go back to his apartment. And they find on the floor of the kitchen half of a woman's body, just the upper half. And on the kitchen table is a saw and an axe and all of the instruments that he's used. So they immediately charge him naturally with a dismemberment murder. And, of course, it was the lower half of her body that had gone into the river. Norris actually is on call that night. He goes down. He takes one look at the body lying on the floor. And he says to them, boys, this is not a murder. And they go, oh, you're wrong, right? Half of body, bloody tools, suspicious action. We're charging him with murder. Well, if you know anything about carbon monoxide, you know that people who are killed by carbon monoxide, there's a chemical reaction in your blood. It makes your blood a very bright cherry red, and your skin flushes pink. People actually look at corpses of people who have died from carbon monoxide poisoning and talk about how healthy they look. Mm-hmm. So Norris looks at this body, and even cut in half, she's rosy.
Oh,
and
man.
He thinks, no. She has to have been dead before he cut her up. Takes her back to Gettler. Gettler runs the test. She's saturated with carbon monoxide. It's at a lethal level. And because we know from tests that he had done that you don't absorb carbon monoxide after death, she has to have been dead before he cut her up. So as it turns out, the two of them had gotten drunk together. They were neighbors. He knocked over a pot on the stove. It put out the flame. They both got wiped by carbon monoxide poisoning, but he wasn't killed. He wakes up. He sees her dead on the floor. He thinks he might have killed her in a drunken stupor or something. And he makes a decision, and it's a bad decision, that he'll deal with this by getting rid of the body. And so this is literally what had actually happened. The police still, you know, they're not used to scientists trumping their evidence.
Yeah.
And they end up going into this New York courtroom, scientists against cops, and the jury believes the scientists.
Oh.
And he gets sent to jail for illegal dismemberment of a body, but not for murder, which would have sent him to the electric chair.
What a story.
It's an amazing story. And as you, about this time, you start seeing policemen, and they weren't used to working with scientists. I mean, we imagine that they were, but these were like really weird guys to them, starting to say, okay, you know, maybe there's evidence
here. There's something here.
Yes. And so by the time Gettler leaves office, you had defense attorneys complaining that juries took him so seriously it was hard to win a case. You see a complete turnaround.
Well, we have some callers online who want to visit with you. So let's go to Kevin in Platteville first. Kevin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is kind of a tangent to what was just being discussed. You mentioned things like the Industrial Revolution and the mass production of chemicals and such. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if your research included accidental poisonings, specifically with industrial chemicals, things that are still in our system and still in our lives that maybe we don't even realize are poisonous, killing us, giving us increased incidences of cancer and the like. And also in like the food service industry that is increasingly becoming these giant conglomerates and concentrated operations leading to unsanitary conditions.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, I looked at poisons in the homicidal sense and in the public health sense, and in the occupational health sense. So some of the things, you know, everything from cigarette smoking, which they knew a lot about in the 1920s, to my surprise, lead and gasoline I looked at, industrial work with radioactive materials, which used to be considered the, you know, the epitome of health. People, they actually used to drink radioactive health drinks. What you find when you start looking at this period is that you have industries mass-producing chemicals and coming up with new ones at a pace that science is really not keeping up with. So, and you see the same pattern today. First, things are heralded as, you know, the greatest chemical discovery ever, better living through chemistry. And then once we live with them a while, you start saying, oops, maybe these aren't so wonderful as we think. And an example of that recently would be bisphenol A, BPA in plastics,
yep,
where we used it in everything. It's a very handy plasticizer until we discovered that we were also swallowing it constantly. And that it has really some very interesting and unfortunate hormonal effects. One of the things, just to follow up briefly, that I found to my surprise, which is why I started doing this chemistry blog, is that a lot of the chemicals that were problems in the 1920s and 30s still plague us today. We don't regulate them that well. Carbon monoxide, we still have 50,000 carbon monoxide poisonings a year on the average.
Right.
Lead is still an enormous problem. Just to give you an example of that, the FDA just ran some tests and found it sprinkled through a lot of commercial lipsticks at some levels. And the FDA won't tell which companies they are, but one of the lipsticks was 11 times the EPA safe standard.
Oh, and they won't tell?
And they would not tell who it was. I'm sure it's like a trade secret thing. There is a campaign for safe cosmetics that's given up some of the names if you go to their website. Mercury is turning up in cosmetics again. Face whitening creams tend to be full of mercury. And just to follow one other, yeah, I can go on and on with this stuff, yeah, because it's fascinating. One of the things that I found interesting, we got rid of leaded gasoline in this country, but it's still leaded in many other countries. Recently, they discovered they had an epidemic of lead poisonings in Boston. And what they discovered was these were people who were making curries with spices grown in India, where people dry cars with leaded gasoline. The soil is saturated with lead there, and these spices were actually lead-loaded. So we really need to be just as aware and vigilant as ever. And so my book is in it. If you get into it, every chapter is a poison. It's actually a handbook of poisons, because I think we actually need to be aware. Right?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for calling, Kevin. Appreciate your call. I want to give Joe in Sun Prairie a chance to join us, too. And by the way, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And now let's turn to Joe in Sun Prairie. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Good morning, Larry and Deborah.
Good morning.
I just returned from Ireland, and I'd never seen anything like this. I'd gone to the Blarney Castle, and you come out the backside of the Blarney Castle, and they have a poison garden. Highlighting all the botanicals, if you will, from belladonna to tobacco to hemp and various other things. But, you know, a big sign saying, don't allow your children into this garden. but it, you know, again, overemphasizing that back in the medieval times, obviously, as you had referred to, you know, the botanicals were quite prominent the way to poison a person, for sure.
And people, I had a friend who went to England and brought me back a guidebook of a poison garden, too. I'm dying to go see one. But people still actually occasionally use garden their way to trying to kill someone. I wrote a story this summer, and I called it How to Make a Heart-Stopping Salad, which I just thought was so clever. But it was a woman in Missouri, and her husband was a cop. And she researched some of these deadly botanicals, and she grew a foxglove in their garden, which produces digitalis, which, in fact, will stop your heart. And she started mixing up salads and just putting digitalis, you know, the foxglove leaves in the salad. Her husband ended up in the hospital with a severe heart condition. And the way they found her, and this is definitely not medieval, is they searched her hard drive. And they found all the research on foxglove. So, yeah, you know, what's interesting is seeing these kinds of things still pop today.
Yeah. Thank you very much, though, for calling. By the way, what's your blog? Your blog is...
Oh, it's called Speakeasy Science. It's a blog about culture and chemistry.
Speakeasy Science. Joe, thank you so much. Clayton in Superior, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Clayton.
Hi. I just wanted to mention a website called scorecard.com. It's just a website. You just punch in your zip code, and it gives you, like, the toxins that are in your water are in there. And, yeah, just wherever you live, it just gives you everything that's there.
And what is it again?
Scorecard.com.
Scorecard.com. Do you know that one?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the ones I've bookmarked. And it's a great idea to take a look. I mean, the trick is dose makes the poison. So you want to look at not only what the toxins are, but what the levels are.
Okay. There you go. Thanks, Clayton, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Roger in Spring Green. Let's go to you next. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I have a question, too, if I may.
Sure.
First one is... You just mentioned lead being taken into spices from contaminated soil.
Mm-hmm.
Do the plants actually take in toxic levels into their tissues, or was there really a cross-contamination from some other method? And then I have one other question, and I'll take my answers off the air. I was in Mexico at Mont Alban and some other you know, old culture places, ruins, and I was looking at the poisons of the area, and I'm just wondering, do you know anything about how older, more primitive cultures figured out which poisons to use on people? One of my theories was, oh, when you capture people from another tribe, test them on them.
Oh, that's a really good question. Plants take up heavy metals, right? They won't take up volatile organics, which is why a lot of the pesticides tend to be in the same way, which is why a lot of pesticides tend to be organic carbon-based things. But they will take up heavy metals. So they'll take up arsenic. They'll take up lead. They'll take up a good example is selenium, which people think is actually part, you know, you need it in a trace amount in your diet. So grains grown in soils that are rich in selenium tend to have a little bit of that in it, which is why lead would naturally be taken up. I don't know the way that all experiments were done. I know, you know, you've probably heard that people used to have poison testers.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I know they did, and I couldn't speak to the Maya specifically, but if you go back to about the time of the Borgias in Italy, who were famous poisoners, right? They mixed up all kinds of experimental poisons, and they just tested them on animals. And the Borgias were famous because they took arsenic. They would stew it up with the blood of poison animals.
Yeah.
They were trying to create something that would, so that it absorbed very quickly at toxic levels through the skin. The story with the Borgias, and so they tested it on a whole range of animals, was that the poison that they came up with that was called La Cantarella was so deadly they could put it on doorknobs and kill people.
Oh.
And that it was destroyed at their death. That actually, because one of the Borgias was a pope. That the Vatican is the rumor anyway. The Vatican had these poison formulas destroyed after his Cesar Borgia's death. So I do know that people experimented, but I actually think they did a lot of it on animals as well as people.
No. Deborah Blum, our guest today, as we talk with her about her new book, The Poisoner's Handbook. Join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And before I forget about it, you're going to be appearing at the Wisconsin Book Festival. So tell us a little about that. When are you going to be?
Oh, it's this Friday at 6:30, and it's at one of the rooms in the Overture Center.
Okay, so 6:30 Friday,
Overture Center.
Overture Center.
I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, well, and you're going on a big book tour.
I've been, like, I seem to be on a nonstop book tour. But, yeah, for the rest of this fall, I'm traveling about every week talking about the book all over the, from New York, actually, to Vancouver, Canada.
All over the place. Well, you know, I'd love to hear another story or two, perhaps, about one or two of the cases that particularly struck you.
Well, one of the things that was always interested to me is, when did we learn to catch poisoners? And so there's a murderess, actually she creeped me out more than anyone else in my book, that I actually come to twice, because she appears early in the book in an arsenic chapter and gets away with it, and then comes back again and is caught. And arsenic at this time period is just an amazingly wonderful poison for your, you know, careful homicidal killer. It mimics natural illness at low doses. But people were always mistaking it for a natural gastroenteritis. It's tasteless. It's odorless.
Yeah.
Ground fine white arsenic and mixed into a food that has just a little texture to it, it's indetectable. And in fact, there were scientists, you know, all, you have to be a little bit crazy quite often to be a scientist, is my experience. They were always taste testing it, right? They'd mix it into pudding and try it. They tried it with wine. What really covered up the taste? Was it coffee? And so arsenic was sort of a poison of choice at that time. This woman decided that she took out an insurance policy on her 17-year-old brother. Actually fed him arsenic in pudding.
Oh.
He died, and the doctor declared it a natural death. Until someone wrote an anonymous letter. They dug him back up. He was loaded with arsenic. But here was the problem. Although they could detect arsenic in a corpse, it was really difficult to figure out the source. They knew it was arsenic, but they couldn't say, the science wasn't precise enough to say, this is arsenic, and it clearly came from A, rat poison, B, cosmetics.
Yeah.
And at that time, arsenic was in medicinal tonics, and women would drink it in a solution. It was called Fowler's solution, because it would give you a beautiful pale complexion. You'd actually low-level poison yourself, and you'd have this translucent pale look that was very popular. So she had Fowler's solution. They charged her, but they couldn't prove it was the Fowler solution. They came up with all these other stories about how he might have gotten it, and she got off. At sort of toward the end of the book, she kills one of her roommates in a much more, and this is a much more gruesome story and horrible story, and it involves pedophilia and all kinds of creepy things I won't go into here. By this time, they're actually able to say, this is arsenic, but it's also contaminated with A, B, and C, and we know it's this precise brand of rat poison. They can find out where she bought the rat poison, and she goes to the electric chair. Everyone went to the electric chair then, right?
Oh, wow.
The turnaround for getting convicted and being executed was sometimes 4 or 5 months. It was, and that was one of the things that really struck me, is how fast the system was, right?
Wow.
Whew. Yes.
Barbara in Milwaukee, let's turn to you. Hi.
Hi. Your discussion reminded me of Agatha Christie,
mm-hmm.
who I think was writing during the 30s and seemed to be a kind of ahead of her time with her the poisons that she mentioned in her books, like foxglove, and I think it's called thallium.
Oh, yeah, I did a whole chapter on thallium. Thallium's a wonderful poison. Agatha Christie had actually worked in a pharmacy as a dispensary, and her very first book was strychnine, and she was famous for loving to use poison. She was way ahead of her time. And one of the things I tried to do with this book, because I love those early 20th century mysteries, was write it kind of in that Christie style.
Yeah.
You know, it's fairly narrative, but Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, used arsenic, Georgette Heyer, nicotine, thallium, Agatha Christie wrote about in The Pale Horse. And it's a wonderful poison except for one thing. I mean, if you wanted to kill someone. It actually is incredibly hard to find in the body. It metabolizes away wonderfully. But if you get to a lethal level, it makes your hair fall out. So it gives it's a total giveaway. And that was actually one of the clues in Christie's book, if you knew anything about the poison.
Oh, thank you, Barbara, for calling. And Carol in Kenosha, let's turn to you now. Hi, Carol.
Larry, this is so interesting because I was poisoned a few years ago by fumes that emanated from my microwave when I heated one of these herbal bags that you use for muscle pain or something. It was like midnight because I was going to bed. And there must have been something wet, some food substance on the microwave plate. Because after I was heating this bag, I started to smell these awful fumes. And when I opened the door, it just hit me. Just this horrible fumes coming out of there. And when I picked up the bag, there was a big burnt spot on the fabric. So I threw it right out the door. I opened windows. I put a fan in the window, drawing the air out of the kitchen, and then I went to bed. And I couldn't sleep. It just kept bothering me, and after a while, I realized I was having difficulty breathing, feeling this weight in my chest. So I drove myself to the emergency, and once I got in there, told them I had shortness of breath and all, I was just shocked to find I'm suddenly on an EKG, and there's oxygen on me, and I've got doctors and nurses all around me. But when I told them what had happened, no one would believe me.
Really? So I was going to ask you if they'd run a tox screen, but obviously they didn't do that.
Well, I'm an older lady, and I have a feeling they thought I was just trying to kind of do myself in.
There's a lot of, you know, when we go back to talking about natural plants being poisonous, I mean, it's a mistake to think that natural means naturally safe, right? It sounds to me, though, I will tell you, like you handled it perfectly. You got rid of it. You aired it out. You went to the doctor. You saved yourself by being smart, and they should have appreciated that.
The story to them just didn't make sense, and even on the report, it was buckwheat.
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you, Carol. And I hope you have a chance to take a look at Deborah's book, because it sounds like you have kind of developed an interest in this subject based on your own very bad experiences. Deborah, it's wonderful to have you here again.
It's just been a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
And the book, The Poisoner's Handbook, it's, you know, get it anywhere, any of your local bookstores. And you're going to be again Friday?
At the Overture Center at 6:30 at the Wisconsin Book Festival.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Deborah Blum, the Helen Firstbrook Franklin Professor of Journalism at the UW-Madison and author of The Poisoner's Handbook. And once more, your blog is?
Speakeasy Science.
Speakeasy Science. All right. Thank you so much. Well, science is kind of on my mind today, and I hope it's on your mind, too. We're going to continue talking about science, and we're going to turn our attention to the lowly potato chip, the lowly potato chip? Actually, we're going to talk about potato chips and scientific experiments with Alan Kurzweil of Providence, Rhode Island. He is a fellow in the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University, a novelist, and he and his son, Max, created a science kit for kids and teachers based on potato chips. And we'll learn more about that next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.